My name's Jim Lewis. Welcome to CSIS. I'm glad we could pull this together. I'm glad you could make it on a rainy day. What are we going to do today? We're going to hear remarks first from Arnie Kanter, then of course from John Rood, and then we'll have a brief Q&A with John, followed by Beth McCormick and Frank Ruggiero, who will also make a few remarks and take a few questions. Well, I'm really happy to do this event. For a long time, I used to say that nothing ever changed in export controls, and so you didn't have to pay attention. And this year, you had to pay attention, and that's some of what we're going to be hearing about. Let me introduce our first two speakers. I'll start with Arnie. He's a principal and founding member of the Scowcroft Group. And I know everyone knows everybody here, so I'll be brief. He was Undersecretary of State from 91 to 93. I think I worked for you then. He was also Special Assistant to the President in the first Bush 41 administration, where I also had to obey his commands. And he served in a variety of functions at the State Department, but I escaped that part. So we're very grateful that he's here. He's also a member, or has previously been a member, of the PIFIAB and the Defense Policy Board. He will say a few remarks to put this in a strategic context. John, of course, you all know. He is the acting Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security and has been in that position since 2007. Prior to that, he was the Assistant Secretary for International Security and Nonproliferation, the Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Counterproliferation Strategy, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Forces Policy. He worked for Senator Kyle, as many of us know, and prior to that he was at the Central Intelligence Agency, which is, I guess, where we first met.
Yes.
So a lot of us in the room know each other. I'm very eager to hear both of our speakers. And with that, let me turn it over to Arnie.
Thank you, Jim, and thank you for inviting me. I must say, if you were working for me in the first Bush administration, I couldn't tell from your behavior. I am grateful for this opportunity to steal a little bit of John Root's time, but I'm sure not his thunder, to try to offer some scene-setting views, both about defense trade in general and about two recently signed defense trade cooperation treaties in particular. As I'm certain everyone in this room would agree, defense trade regulations, at their essence, are designed to try to strike a balance between two fundamentally competing objectives. On the one hand, we want to advance a variety of national security, foreign policy, and economic interests by facilitating the transfer of defense technology, equipment, and services. On the other hand, we want to try to protect those very same interests by restricting the transfers of certain defense technology, equipment, and services to certain destinations and certain end users. And the means by which we try to strike this balance today is what we all know and love as the current arms control licensing process. And I think the current process, it's fair to say, has both its fans and its critics, and my guess is that no one is always a fan and no one is always a critic. The fans typically point out that the current system actually does a very good job of protecting U.S. defense technology. The critics typically point out that the current system simply errs too much on the side of restricting transfers at the price of sometimes significant delays, various conditions and restrictions that are imposed on transfers, and simple unpredictability about whether and when what kind of decision is going to emerge. And that, taken together, these kinds of problems end up hurting us more than helping us in terms of advancing the interests I described. Now, there are three broad and potentially complementary ways to help address the criticisms, but do so in the context of what is the continuing and essential requirement of striking the right balance. One way is to make the current system simply work better, work more efficiently, so that the time required to act on license applications is shortened and the backlog of pending license requests is reduced. And I think it's fair to say there have been some recent improvements in the process and progress in getting more timely decisions. It's easier to imagine that if Secretary Rood and his people had more resources, they could do even better. And I think the at least as I read the press release describing the President's January 22nd export control directive, that directive promises to do just that. That is more resources in order to produce more efficiency. And I look forward to hearing what John will be saying on that subject. A second way to deal with some of these criticisms while striking the right balance is to recalibrate the balance between risks and benefits in deciding what technologies need to be controlled. There are frequent, and in my view, often justified complaints that there are just too many mundane, low-tech, widely available things that are interpreted as being on the munitions list and therefore requiring an export license, although you probably won't get an argument that they are mundane, low-tech, and widely available. And as we all know, a rather large percentage of all arms export control licenses are for unclassified technology, which suggests there are probably some opportunities to exempt some of these things from the kinds of controls to which they're now subject. I just can't tell from reading the press release and the news reports how the export control directive will deal with what I call the recalibration of the risk-benefit balance. Now, a third way is to recalibrate the balance between risks and benefits by taking the destinations and end users into account. If the second way was about technology, recalibration with respect to technologies, the third way is recalibration with respect to destination and end users. To take the starkest case, it would seem intuitive that exports to trusted partners and our closest allies typically pose the least security risks at the same time as they promise the greatest benefits to U.S. security, national security, foreign policy, and economic interests. So that's the idea of recalibrating the balance with respect to destinations and end users. Now, of course, the current system already does this to some degree by exempting some destinations and end users, such as under the Canadian exemption. But as a general matter, exporting an unclassified defense item to the UK, with whom we share the most sensitive intelligence data and most sensitive nuclear technology, goes through the same case-by-case licensing process as would exporting a classified item to Pakistan or Poland go through. That doesn't sound right, but I think that's a fair description of the system. Now, two recently signed bilateral defense cooperation trade treaties, one with the UK and a very similar one with Australia, I believe hold the promise, but by no means the guarantee, of taking a qualitatively different approach than does the current system on how to strike the risk-benefit balance. These treaties with two of our closest allies essentially put qualified British and Australian entities pretty much on the same basis as their U.S. counterparts in the U.S. That's a big idea. It's a big idea, and depending on how you look at it, you can view it as either representing a fundamental reconceptualization of what is meant by defense export to these qualified entities, or you can look at it as a true paradigm shift that creates single markets of qualified entities within which the very idea of an export simply is no longer relevant. The term export doesn't fit, doesn't have relevance in these single markets, within these single markets. Now, given some of the faces I recognize in this room, I think it need be said that these two treaties were not negotiated at the behest of the defense industry, nor do they have as their primary objective making it easier for defense companies to do business in the U.S., the U.K., and Australia. That's not what they're for. Their purpose, at least from a U.S. perspective, is to enhance the capability of U.S. forces to perform their missions by making combined operations among U.S., U.K., and Australian forces more effective, and by getting the best technology and equipment in the hands of U.S. forces as quickly, efficiently, and economically as possible. That's what I take away to be the two primary objectives of the treaties from a U.S. perspective. And as such, I think that these treaties should be seen as being part of the larger strategic and political relationships we have with these two allies. Two things strike me about the treaties. One is not only that they exist, that they've been negotiated and signed, but that they were negotiated and signed in what may be record time for a formal treaty to which the U.S. is party. And when I heard that treaties were being negotiated, you know, I thought I'd talk to my kids about it, and they would talk to their kids about it and all that. That's not what has happened. This is a remarkable achievement. And I think it's a tribute to some extraordinarily hard work and dedication of the respective teams, negotiating teams, including some people in this room who were committed to take a fresh approach and to drive to success. And they did so, and I think they are to be congratulated. The other thing that strikes me about these agreements is that, at least with benefit of hindsight, bringing our defense trade relationships into a better alignment with the other dimensions of our political and strategic relationships with these two allies is obvious, and is obviously right. I mean, sort of, why didn't we do this before? It's sort of obviously right. And I hope, and perhaps even trust, that the Senate accordingly will see these two treaties as being relatively straightforward, clearly in the interest of the United States, non-controversial, and they will act promptly to ratify them. Now, as I indicated, while the phrase defense trade cooperation appears in the formal title of these treaties, if you are putting accents on these words, I believe the accent needs to be more on defense than on trade. But having said that, I believe that to the extent these agreements will actually achieve the objectives for which they were negotiated, the extent will depend exquisitely on how successful they are in making the transfer of defense technology between, say, qualified U.S. and U.K. entities about as uncomplicated and efficient as a similar transfer would be between any two U.S. qualified entities in the United States. That ought to be the benchmark. That ought to be the goal. And those prospects, in turn, will depend on how the treaty terms are operationalized and implemented. The cognoscenti know, the implementing agreement between the USG and HMG has just been signed. It's been posted on the web, but I think I at least will need a bit more time to digest and understand exactly what it says and what it does. We'll also want to see the list of approved projects that will be covered under the treaty, a list that I hope will be both lengthy and broad. We need to see what technologies are going to be exempted from the terms of the treaty, exemptions which I hope will be few in number and narrowly defined. And finally, the regulations that will actually govern how defense companies will operate under this treaty will need to be drafted, to be done. I really hope that there will be close and continuing interaction between the government and industry as these regulations are written, so that they result in a regime that companies want to be part of and want to use, rather than come to regard them as more of the same, another old wine in new bottles exercise. But I would say that the burden of avoiding that latter outcome falls at least as much on industry as on government. This is not a one-way dialogue. And I think that as the writing of the regs proceeds and as implementation of the treaty gets underway, industry is going to need to appreciate that, at least initially, some of the provisions and procedures may not be as far-reaching as they would like, because there's a need to gain and benefit from some experience in how this new approach, this paradigm shift, if you will, is going to work before you can take more ambitious steps. At the same time, government needs to understand that if the old system, if the new system looks about the same, or is just as, in the view of some, as cumbersome and plagued by the same problems as the present system, then industry participation will be limited, there won't be much experience to be gained, and the benefits of the treaties simply will not be realized. So there really is a two-way implicit deal that has to be part of the process going forward. Put simply, I think industry needs to have some understanding that we will need to walk before we can run, and government needs to have some understanding that we need to set out with the objective of running as soon as possible, even as we're learning to walk. Let me close by returning to a point that I made earlier, namely that these two treaties can be viewed as taking a different conceptual approach to determining the risk-benefit balance in defense trade. That is, for allies with whom we have the greatest convergence of strategic interests, on whom we will depend most in confronting challenges to those interests, and with whom we have the most confidence that the risks of technology compromise will be minimal. With those allies and partners, we will have the most liberal process governing defense trade. That's the story of these two treaties, in my view. But one could imagine taking those, let me call them premises, and deriving a set of criteria that could be used to evaluate other allies and other security partners, and tailoring defense processes to the evaluation of those relationships with respect to those criteria. Now, my bet is that as we gain more experience with these agreements, we'll get a better sense of what they represent. On the one hand, they may represent two unique cases because our relationships with the UK and Australia are unique. Or they may turn out to be prototypes for a more far-reaching overhaul of the defense export control system. Too soon to make any bets about that. We'll see, but just keep that thought in mind. And with that, let me turn things over to John Root. Thank you.
Well, first let me thank Jim Lewis for that nice introduction, and thank you all for the chance to speak to you today. Arnie, I really want to congratulate you on, a very, very thorough and thought-provoking introductory set of remarks. You're a tough act to follow here, but I'll do my best. As I look around the room, there are a number of familiar faces and people who have been involved in this business for some time. I see Mark Bitterman, someone that I've worked with for years and I know has a lot of interest in this particular area. And so, it's a challenge to tell Mark something he doesn't already know in this area. But, you know, when I was getting ready for these remarks, I thought, this is a very exciting time to be involved in defense trade and export controls. I say that to my wife, and she doesn't understand, why I'm at work until 9 or 10 o'clock working on these things. But I really do think this is an interesting period of time we have gone through in the last not quite a year, where there's been a tremendous amount of change accomplished and reforms accomplished in the defense trade and export controls area, and we're not finished yet. We, if you will, as in tennis, we've hit a good shot, but we've got to follow through on that, and we know that in the administration. We have a limited period of time left, but we are clearly in this area sprinting to the finish, and I think there's a lot of excellent work still ahead of us. I also, before I roll into the substance of some of the things that we've done here in the administration, and what I'd like to do in my remarks today is talk to you about some of the reforms we're doing both internally, some of the things we've done to try to improve our business processes to make the system more responsive, as Arnie mentioned in one of his three ways to improve the system. Just talk about some of the more fundamental things we've done, as he talked about again in one of his three areas with the defense trade treaties. And also to talk about the recent directives signed by President Bush that will also change the system. Before I roll into that, though, I do want to recognize some of the people here from the administration who have played towering roles in leading this work. Frank Ruggiero is, of course, here. He's our Deputy Assistant Secretary at the State Department. Beth McCormick, the head of DITSA. And Frank Kenlon from the AT&L over in DOD. And, of course, Maureen Tucker is also here from my office, who's played a very substantial role and made a major contribution in these areas. But as I say, let's talk a little bit about the substance. I think, as Arnie framed up well, we do have an abiding need where we've got to have strong defense trade and export control procedures for our national security needs, but we also do need to balance that with our responsibilities to make as predictable and transparent and efficient a business environment as we can. Today, I want to discuss three areas related to defense trade reform that have been a focus since last May for me personally. These are changes to the way the State Department's Directorate of Defense Trade Controls does business. As I said, the recent NSPDs signed by, or presidential directives signed by President Bush, and then the treaties with the UK and Australia. And I'd like to first give you some context on these issues. It's, of course, paramount importance that we protect sensitive technologies to maintain U.S. military superiority. Threats to our safety grow daily. I receive intelligence briefings all the time that talk about the efforts of our potential adversaries to develop capabilities specifically keyed against our capabilities, to exploit our weaknesses. We certainly are doing that every day, and there's no question that planners in countries of concern are doing that with us every day, and we do see specific information on them seeking U.S. technologies and that produced by our allies. Well, we've got to, of course, strike the right balance to make sure that the measures we take to protect this technology against diversion don't undermine the ability of U.S. companies to conduct legitimate business transactions. Companies have simply got to have the ability to reliably fulfill their customers' requests if we're going to ask these same companies, to produce cutting-edge technology for us in the United States. U.S. industry, I think, has the part of the equation dealing with producing cutting-edge technology down cold, as we would say. Our military forces and our security services are simply equipped with the best technology in the world, and that's because of the efforts of U.S. industry. We recognize in the Bush administration that we needed, though, to do some work on the other part of that equation, which is having a timely, transparent, and predictable procedure to govern trade in truly sensitive technologies. We've taken some major steps, and I dare say I think what we've done in less than a year here is more significant than what's been accomplished, certainly if you combine everything done in at least the last decade and perhaps far beyond that. But we know we've still got a long way to go. This isn't the end of the story. We're closer to the beginning of this book than we are to the end. So let me talk about a few of the things we've done in the State Department to improve the way that we have we regulate trade in this area. In fiscal year 2008, we at the State Department planned to license nearly $100 billion in defense trade, about $96 billion would be the upper bound of our estimate. We continue to be busier than ever. We have seen a growth of about nearly 10%, 8% growth in the number of applications we receive. Total licenses, we think, will rise in fiscal year 2008 to 85,000. That's up from 69,000 in fiscal year 2006. 85,000 licenses is a huge number of things to process. And I have this recurring fear that when I meet with my colleagues from industry, they generally have one case that they raise with me. And I can virtually be assured I know nothing about it when they bring it up because of that volume. I mean, it's just a huge responsibility that we have. First and foremost, again, to assure ourselves that these licensing decisions protect our security interests. But also, we want to make this process as timely and, to the extent we can, predictable. We have, firstly, to accomplish this challenge, brought a new management team on board, and I am very pleased with the results so far. Assistant Secretary Steve Mull has overseen this effort. We've also have, as I mentioned, Deputy Assistant Secretary Frank Ruggiero. Frank and Steve have just done an outstanding job. Frank Ruggiero, of course, is a veteran of the U.S. national security community, and I know he's committed to making this system as responsive as possible. We've also hired a new managing director, Bob Kovac, who is dedicated to making this our licensing deadlines and our process much more thoughtful and consistent. You probably, I imagine, people in the audience with a lot of experience, many years in dealing with the U.S. system, say those are nice promises, but how are we doing? And we keep statistics that I and others receive on a weekly basis. And the trend is that we are, I think, in our metrics, substantially improving. Take, for an example, number of cases we have pending. As I mentioned last May, we had a much larger number. We had 7,200 cases. We've reduced that by over 50% to 3,400 over that same time period. Now, that's one metric. There are fewer licenses pending. Secondly, the most important ones, those related to ongoing areas of combat, things like Operation Iraqi Freedom and our activities in Afghanistan, those are being completed in 7 days or less under our current system. What I hear most about in these office calls, as I mentioned, is people raising a particular case that has been pending for an inordinately long period of time. And here we've seen the most dramatic progress. Those cases that have been pending over 60 days, we've reduced that number by 95%. over the time period that I mentioned, from 400 to 20 today. We've also been examining our longstanding policies to look at structural changes we can make to improve our processes. So we've changed our licensing policies so that employees of foreign companies who are nationals from NATO or EU countries or Japan, Australia, or New Zealand are now considered authorized under an approved license or TAA. This will alleviate the need for companies to seek non-disclosure agreements for these nationals. And we think it recognizes the inherent low risk of transferring technologies to these nationals from these countries. We're also working with the Department of Commerce to clarify an issue that a number of people in the aerospace industry have raised with us, which is the applicability of what's called 17C controls. That is to say, parts and components certified by the FAA. We've taken a look at this and tried to find a way to make this distinction quite simple. And last night I signed a Federal Register notice that will be published shortly that will clarify how this is done. This will be an interim rule, but we think we have a very simple and straightforward means by which companies will be able to make these determinations themselves. But certainly, as I mentioned, we have put this forward as an interim rule because we expect we'll receive some feedback. We're similarly reviewing a number of other processes to try to eliminate bottlenecks where they occur. And our metrics continue to show progress in this regard, and I hope you also are seeing that in your business. We had another interesting thing, as I mentioned, that's occurred, which is the President's put forward directives on how to improve our defense trade activities. And where this effort, I think, really began is a number of people had been thinking about this for some time, but I thought Arnie's remarks about the need for a dialogue with industry were very well taken, because last year there was a coalition of industry groups with AIA and the Chamber of Commerce and NAM that got together, and they came forward with a set of, I thought, very pragmatic and straightforward recommendations that were a catalyst to our thinking in the administration. Now, we didn't limit ourselves to what the coalition had proposed, but it spurred our thinking, and when we got together, we tried to think even bigger thoughts about what kinds of reforms could be put in place. And where that story takes us is to the issuance of these directives from President Bush. He signed them on January 22nd. There's two of them. One covers the munitions license process that the State Department administers. The other one covers the commerce system. I'll let my commerce colleagues describe the dual-use system and focus my remarks on the one that the State Department administers. But let me talk about a few of the things there. I think one of the headline change has been the fact that we've adopted a deadline, if you will, for our activities, where under the new procedures, the State Department will implement a process to produce a review and decisions on export authorization requests under the ITAR within 60 days after these license applications are submitted. Now, there'll be certain exceptions to this for national security reasons, but this will be the guideline that we follow. And this is by direction of the President, so we're certainly going to take that very seriously. For years, I'd heard a number of people say, why can't the State Department munitions system be closer to the commerce system? And I think this is a major step in that regard. But we're not merely setting a 60-day timeline to say, wouldn't that be a nice goal? In order to reliably meet that, we have looked at, and the President has now directed us to address the various problems and issue areas that have prevented us from achieving these kind of timelines in the past. And secondly, we've put ourselves on a path to have the resources to do this. In other words, we don't simply want to have the State Department position where we're not living up to the directive the President has given to us. We've positioned ourselves, we think, in this to arrive at a new process. So I'll go through some of these specifics. But that's really, I think, the overarching thought behind them. Resources are important. In government, we don't always do as good a job of funding our mandates, shall we say. And here, we at the State Department have a requirement to submit a plan to the OMB by March 22nd, which will outline the resources we need to carry out this new directive. The plan will include both the financial and the personnel resources necessary for us to execute these new responsibilities. We expect that one big change is that part of the State Department's Defense Trade Controls Directorate will be self-financed. We expect the self-financing mechanism to be up near about 75%, as much as 75% of the activities there. This is not the only area of the government that, of course, has self-financing mechanisms. There are other models, such as the FAA or other agencies that we can draw from. But we have not yet settled on the specific means by which we'll accomplish the self-financing mechanism, but it's something we're working very hard on. Second area is the commodity jurisdiction process. I mean, where this starts is, does the Commerce Department control this, or does the State Department control this? And I see people like Peter Lichtenbaum in the audience who have had deep experience with these kind of commodity jurisdiction fights. Here, the President's directed at the National Security Council, along with the State Defense and Commerce Departments, to issue revised guidance regarding how we're going to make these decisions in a timely manner. We've got to resolve these disputes under the President's guidance within 60 days, and we intend to come out shortly with a new process in this regard. We're also, the other area where we have difficulty with time delays is resolving disputes among agencies. People that have worked in the administration know the Hatfield and McCoy syndrome that can develop in this area. Well, the President's directed us to establish by March 1st an interagency committee to facilitate the timely resolution of these kinds of disputes. The committee will be chaired by Frank Ruggiero, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Trade Controls. State and Defense will be permanent members of the committee, along with the Commerce Department participating when there are commodity jurisdiction issues, and Homeland Security when it addresses something in their purview, such as compliance, enforcement, and specific commodity jurisdictions related to technologies that are applicable to Homeland Security. And other executive branch agencies, of course, will participate as needed. Another area where we would like to seek some improvement is in the congressional notification process. God bless the founders of our country who gave us the system we have, but in a number of areas, it was set up to produce checks and balances and to slow the work of the government, and it does. And so we would like to work with our partners in the legislative branch to try to improve that area of work. And so we will we are tasked to do that. By May 22nd, by the President, and our goal is to make that process more timely, predictable, and transparent while recognizing the legitimate role that the Congress has in this area. Another thing that we need to do is, underlying this whole process, is the process improvements, the productivity improvements that come from automation and electronic licensing. I see a lot of high-tech representatives from high-tech companies in the audience, and I imagine this is may sound more basic, but we at the State Department need to finish upgrading our electronic licensing system. We would like to have the simple goal that all reviewers, whether that's in the State Department or in some other agency, can electronically receive these applications, they can distribute them, and they can respond to the full range of documentation and other material that's required as part of the licensing process. We don't have that capability today. We'd like to have it soon. And this is an area where resources matter and I think can make a difference. And so we will, by July 22nd, we are required to have a plan to achieve this kind of electronic interoperability among the different departments and agencies and to come forward with a way to accomplish this kind of electronic licensing review. So with that, in talking about some of the things the President has directed and that we're in the process of implementing, let me turn to another area that Arnie highlighted with respect to the defense trade treaties. I do think these are landmark treaties, and I think their significance over time will become much better known. This is another one that, again, when I talked to my wife, or I was in Phoenix recently and talked to some of my old friends, the significance is not necessarily appreciated now, but I do think that this is going to produce and is part of a different paradigm and a new way of doing business with our closest allies in the world. Of course, the U.S.-UK treaty was submitted to the Senate, was signed by the President this summer and submitted in September to the Senate. The Australia treaty was submitted in December. These treaties were negotiated over a very short period of time, and in coming to this idea, I recall when a number of us were just conceptualizing how this could be done, we looked at a lot of the efforts that had been done before. And we tried to learn from them, whether it was the defense trade reform initiatives or the ITAR waiver process or a number of other activities to see is there something we could do. And we came up with the idea of pursuing a treaty. And it was something that I think without the commitment of the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of the UK and certainly the Prime Minister of Australia at a later date, this wouldn't have been possible. And it was that kind of direction and the intense commitment of the people involved, such as the people from the administration I mentioned earlier, that allowed us to do this. In the interest of time, I'll just focus on the UK treaty. The treaty we have with Australia is very similar, and we're pursuing a very similar approach. You, of course, have the treaties, and then you will need what we call implementing arrangements, essentially a legally binding agreement governing how this will go forward. I was very pleased to sign that with the UK recently. We are very close to completion of a companion agreement with Australia, and so I expect we will have that done shortly. Now, we still have additional work to do, and certainly Arnie's right to say these are complicated issues, and so it will take time for people to see that. But I do think that as these issues are digested, it will become much more clear the significance of these efforts. But let me talk briefly before I talk about the details of the treaty and the implementing arrangements and things of that nature. Just talk about our rationale for pursuing these treaties. We do have a special relationship with these countries. That's said a lot, but I think when you look at the reasons that we have this special relationship and how it's special, it just reinforces the uniqueness of our relationships with these countries. We have, of course, starts with shared values, a shared outlook on the world, and a deep and longstanding cooperation over decades in dealing with the very threats to our security and our existence. For example, we've engaged in innovative defense trade and cutting-edge technology sharing arrangements with the UK since at least World War II, now some 70 years ago. And in that conflict, of course, we worked to defeat fascism. During the Cold War, we worked to defeat communism. And today we have another extraordinarily difficult challenge that we're facing, and that the threat from extremism and terrorism. So we're both the U.S. and the U.K. have experienced very significant terror attacks on our soil in 9/11 and on 7/7 in the U.K. The Bali bombings demonstrate that the Australians have also been affected in a very significant way. Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations, we found, will use whatever technology they can acquire to accomplish their goals. As we've seen in thwarted attacks, whether that's in the United States, the U.K., or elsewhere, it's a very resourceful foe we're facing. They will use traditional hardware, such as the ubiquitous cell phone or garage door openers or other technologies, to do what is necessary in their eyes to inflict damage on us and our allies. So it's a conflict also with many fronts, if you will. It's a global conflict. The United Kingdom and Australia are certainly our staunchest allies in this struggle. We have a number of other coalition partners also. But in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, they are standing shoulder to shoulder with us. And in this new security environment, we've got to achieve the ability to rapidly move technologies and goods and services to keep pace with this very quick and rapidly evolving threat. Our military intelligence and other security people need to be able to efficiently share information. They need to move these technologies, and especially where we have combined operations on the front lines. And I say front lines, whether that's in Basra or Kandahar or New York or London or Sydney. The front lines are difficult to distinguish in the sort of conflict that we're involved in, and we've got to have a system that's responsive. And our defense and security companies, we think, need to be able to collaborate in a way where they can develop technologies more effectively and efficiently than they have in the past. And so it was against this kind of backdrop that we looked at how can we develop a new solution, a new paradigm, for take into account the large scale of economic trade between our companies. I mean, take the United Kingdom. I often read about foreign investment in the United States and trade flows, and it's generally associated with some of the developing economies around the world. But bear in mind, the United Kingdom is the largest foreign investor in the United States, at over $250 billion. The United States is the largest foreign investor in the United Kingdom, to the tune of $350 billion. The UK is our largest defense trade partner. We at the Department of State approved over 9,400 licenses for defense exports to the UK in fiscal year 2007 alone, worth nearly $12 billion. So we looked at how are we handling this large volume of trade as we tried to put together a new regime to be embodied in these treaties. And we found that over the last 2 years at the State Department, we'd processed over 15,000 export licenses for defense trade with the UK. And we had approved over 99.9% of them, one at a time. And so we looked at our defense trade statistics with Australia. They were lower, but there was a similar approval rate and a heavy volume as our second largest trading partner. And we also, as I said, took into account some of the less than hoped for results from our defense trade reform efforts over in recent years. And it just reminded me of a quote from John Maynard Keynes where he said, the difficulty lies not so much in developing new ideas as in escaping from old ones. And I think clearly we did need to do that. So the president gave us the direction, negotiate a treaty with the UK and Australia that would support joint military and counterterrorism operations, speed R&D production in support of the next generation of defense and security technologies, enable development of the most effective countermeasures to combat terrorism, and to leverage each other's experience and try to not duplicate efforts in these efforts for R&D production support and so on. The treaty accomplishes a new structure, and so we'll establish a community of the U.S. government and Her Majesty's government, or in the case of Australia, with the Australian government that will include the various ministries and agencies and entities of the governments. We will also include companies and facilities in our respective countries. So exports of most classified and unclassified defense goods, technology, and services are going to be able to be permitted to move into and move freely within this agreed community, as long as these activities are in support of combined military and counterterrorism operations, cooperative security and defense R&D production and support efforts. For specific security projects where one of our countries is the sole end user. And this, I think, will be a very big change. I think what Arnie called a big idea. From where today you have numerous government approvals that are necessary first for companies to hold a discussion about what projects they might pursue and what technologies might be involved. Then you have the further approvals necessary to ship hardware and know-how to each other. And then, of course, even to move engineers and people within projects and within companies, branches of companies, that typically requires an export license today or maybe several of them. So we still have to develop the specific list of activities that will fall under the treaty scope, but we envision today, and our goal is that the treaty cover the bulk of the efforts between our respective countries. We think some good examples of eligible activities will be things like IEDs, IED counter IED technology, that is to say improvised explosive devices and the ways to deal with those. Our forces face these things on a daily basis. We think some aspects of missile defense cooperation, of armor cooperation, surface ship development. There's a system the UK is pursuing called the Bowman Radio Interoperability Project. We think that will be something that will qualify. There will be, we think, in the case of the UK, as an example, a number of UK-only projects that we expect will qualify, such as ASTER. There will be some exclusions, and we are very close to completing work on a first list of excluded technologies. We have the guiding principle we have used is the one that Arnie Kanter articulated, which is to try to keep the list of exclusions to the minimum required. We will have a first iteration of that, and we expect over time that this list will evolve. What we come forward with in the first instance, we don't think will be the final answer for time immemorial. There are some significant improvements in the treaty and our ability to enforce it. As an example, in the UK, technology exported under this treaty will be called restricted and be governed, therefore, by the Official Secrets Act. UK export laws will also apply, so we think there's a substantial improvement in the ability to prosecute violators and to enforce this. retransfers and re-exports, of course, outside these approved communities, whether that be in the United States, Australia, and the U.K., those things will still require permission. Let's say in the case of the United States and the U.K., it'll require permission from the U.K. MOD as well as the United States government, and a violation of that will, as a minimum, be a violation of the Official Secrets Act, perhaps U.K. export control laws as well as U.S. export control laws. We do think we have to have a number of procedures to make this process continue to evolve, and we're planning to continue to rely on the Defense Trade Advisory Group, where we seek industry feedback. There may be other fora that we want to also look at this. Now, we usually get the example, or the question I often do, exactly how would this work, and can you give me an example? With apologies to J.K. Rowling, let's consider an example, a hypothetical example, that the U.S. and the U.K. are both independently developing a personal invisibility cloak like the one used by Harry Potter. So to develop this personal invisibility cloak, let's assume that our Defense Department in the United States and the Ministry of Defense in the U.K. decide to join forces. Instead of developing their own invisibility cloaks, they'll work together to leverage our efforts. We could envision they might negotiate an MOU as to how they would do this. So once that was done, our two governments would then agree to add the invisibility cloak to the list of approved projects, and each government would select its contractor team. Under the treaty, instead of each company and preparing and seeking State Department approvals and licenses, which would usually take about 45 to 60 days. So I guess in the permission to have discussions, 45 to 60 days, after which you get a TAA. After that's received, it might be necessary to move some know-how and technology. Typically, that would be another 45 to 60 days to do that. Might need to stand up the project team. Typically, that'd be another 45, 60 days to start to sign those licenses. And I could go on and on, but you get the point. You've lived this example. Under our new process, what we're hoping is simply after this, the governments have decided to add the invisibility cloak to their list of approved projects. Contractor would check the U.S. government website and say, is my U.K. partner on the list of approved companies and facilities? Check. They're there. Is the invisibility cloak project covered? Check. That's the second check. And third, I need to check the exclusions list. Is invisibility and the cloak for that one of the excluded projects? I'd look there and say, no, it's not excluded. Check. I've checked all three boxes. Now I can cooperate freely with my UK partner, and my UK partner can cooperate freely with me. That's the kind of system that we would like to have. Without seeking prior approvals for the governments, although certainly records will need to be kept, but I think this is a dramatic departure from what we do today. We have a lot more work to do in this area. I don't want to claim success, a total success yet. The treaty has not been ratified by the United States Senate, neither the UK, US-UK treaty, nor the one with the UK, US and Australia. The hard work of implementing the treaties is only partway completed. We feel very good to have finished the implementing arrangement negotiations as quickly as we did. And, of course, this kind of defense and security cooperation isn't really an end in itself. The true measure of merit will be, are we going to be able to field military capabilities that are more advanced at lower cost? Can we do it sooner than is otherwise the case today? When Arnie went through his examples of three areas, I think we're working along those lines and wanting to proceed in those areas. And it reminded me of a Yogi Berra quote that if you want to get where you want to be, it helps to know where you're going, or something to that effect. And I think we know where we want to go and where we want to be, and we're on our way there. Clearly, we have a lot of work to do. We can benefit from some of the interactions that we'll have, including today, I guess, in the next panel with this group here. But I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk to you, and thank Arnie and Jim for putting on this event. I'd be happy to take any questions you might have.
Undersecretary, I'm Luke Engen from Inside U.S. Trade. I just wanted to follow up about the U.K. treaty. Is there any sort of timeline for completing the initial lists of approved projects and excluded items? And also, instead of Harry Potter's cloak, if we're talking about the JSF, can you comment on how much applicability the treaty might have? Thanks.
Sure. We're still doing work on the we have agreed how we will the United States and the United Kingdom have signed an agreement that provides the procedures for how companies and facilities and entities will be part of the approved community. Now we have to populate initial lists, and so we are busy doing that work now. I'm hesitant to make a prediction on when that'll be done because you'll probably put it in your press item tomorrow, and you know we'll have to see whether we're able to live up to that. But I can assure you we're working very hard on that because we have hit all of these gates, if you will, at a rapid clip, and we're trying to sustain that momentum. The second question you asked was with respect to the JSF project. When we looked at the treaty, there was an interesting exercise we went through, which was, do we want to make this applicable in a retroactive fashion, or do we want to start from today forward? And we chose to start from today forward. There is a lot of water under the bridge, so to speak, called JSF, and we did not we didn't want to go back and reestablish a whole set of complicated procedures in an area where this was ongoing. And so where companies have existing export licenses, where they have business arrangements, those they can continue under those. The treaty doesn't invalidate export licenses issued in the past, whether that be for JSF or something else. And frankly, we expect that for most people, if they already have all those procedures and they've been through that process, they will probably not want to change that. If they do, they are welcome to, once the treaty is ratified and its procedures are up and operating, people are willing to are free to make their own decisions and utilize the treaty if they find that's in their interest. And only time will tell how many companies will do that. But I don't want to give the impression we're going to go back and undo those things. I think the major benefit from the treaty is from this point forward with respect to defense cooperation. Yes, sir.
Export solutions. Theoretically, the U.S., U.K., and Australian treaties work great on a homogeneous basis. But as many of the companies that treaty might impact are owned, especially in U.K. and Australia, by non-U.K. and Australian entities, how will the implementation take that into account?
Well, this is going to be a... As we get further into the implementation, I think some of these questions are going to be complex, to say the least. There's an interesting question that arises when you talk about a company. What nationality is it? And in some cases, that's difficult to tell today, and it sort of, frankly, it depends on in the eye of the beholder. That's one of the things we're going to have to work through as we go forward. And you know, I think it may be something that comes up in the next panel that people like Frank Ruggiero and Frank Kenlon and Beth McCormick want to address in some greater detail. But I know we have had these discussions with our colleagues from Australia and the UK, and I think all of us are, let's put it this way, we're aware of the problem and the need to solve it. I can't stand here and tell you we know the exact solutions today for all those. I notice it's in the title of your company, so perhaps you do. You may want to share with us some ideas on how to address that.
One more?
Yes, sir.
Thank you for taking questions. My name is Jeff Abramson with the Arms Control Association. I want to talk a little bit about the DDTC. And the concerns that have been raised about understaffing or procedures there and whether these directives will put additional resources in inclusion of the self-financing mechanism, so there will be more resources than there are now. And then specifically on the self-financing mechanism, how you will avoid a conflict of interest in that space.
What do you mean by a conflict of interest?
Well, where you have the people who are looking for the licenses maybe financing the process whereby they get the licenses. Hmm.
I think for obvious reasons, we do want to avoid any not only an actual conflict of interest, but any appearance of that. I'm not overly concerned about that because I think we have good checks in place where we won't fall into that pitfall. Self-financing agencies, as I say, this is not a new concept. Take the FAA, which regulates the airline industry. they have a self-financing mechanism, and I don't think anyone, I've never heard any serious concern that the FAA is not impartial or that they're in some manner beholden in a dangerous way to the industry concerns. We need to avoid that. There are a number of ways that we could look at doing the self-financing mechanism, and as I say, we have not yet settled on a procedure to do that. So, Luke, I hope that'll be in your story. The State Department official says administration not yet settled on mechanism for self-financing. But we're looking at a number of ways to do that. I do think more resources are clearly called for in this area. If you look at, again, the just simple statistics, but it's not that there is a growth in work, but it's not merely the number of licenses. Today, some of them are very complex. They involve very complicated technologies. And so, I mean, one of the things that we'll have to look at as we look at ways to do this is a way to differentiate the way that we look at a license that, say, involves $1 billion in trade or one that, say, has a $30,000 export value. The billion-dollar license that may have many complex facets to it, should that be treated differently? Should that be, if we look at a way that industry would contribute to offset that, should the person that exports a pretty simple $30,000 product pay the same or be regulated in the same manner as one with a multi-billion-dollar item? These are the kind of questions we're struggling with. That's fine.
How about one more question?
Hi, Bruce Graham from Textron. I want to thank you very much for your efforts and your team's hard work in this. The 17 CSA is going to be released tomorrow on the Federal Register, and had you discussed all these changes with the committees of jurisdiction, and how was it received?
The 17C Federal Register process, I signed it last night. It probably won't be published quite tomorrow, but it's in the pipeline, so to speak, so it'd be a matter of days. Early next week. And we have talked to the committees about how we would go about doing it. Now bear in mind, I think that's just given their interest and our shared interest in working closely with them on these issues. That's why we closely coordinated with them. But recall, I mean, the whole effort is just to clarify under the existing statutory structure which of the two systems a particular item would fall under. And at least I personally, I saw some very persuasive presentations from industry about some areas of confusion that we certainly didn't mean to create. We at the State Department don't wish to regulate nor control a lot of this this sort of trade, and I hope that you'll see in the regulation or the clarification rather that I signed out last night that people like Frank Ruggiero and others have come up with a very simple, I think, straightforward way to distinguish that we hope will be clear and allow risk-averse people in industry to properly classify something as civilian or a dual use, rather, or military. So thank you. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
We can get a PMI up here. It's a good challenge. Frank Ruggiero, as you've heard, is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Defense Trade and Regional Security and the Political Military Bureau at State. He's served in several positions before, both at State and Commerce, and brings some pretty good experience to this process. So we have two real experts up here. Theory was we would give them each 10 minutes or so to add some additional remarks to what you've already heard, and then they would take maybe some more detailed questions from you for as much time as we have or as they have. So I don't know who wants to go first. Beth, do you want to start off? Or?
Actually, Frank's got statutory and regulatory authority, so he should probably go first if he says anything.
What Jim didn't mention in my storied past was that I used to work for him. So Jim was my boss a couple years ago. What I thought we could do, I don't think I can add much to what Undersecretary Rood said in terms of the overview of what we've done on internal process reforms at in the PM Bureau, what the President has ordered us to do on the presidential directives, and then also what the President ordered us to do on the treaties. So if you want to just open it to questions, that might be the most efficient way to go forward because we have about 45 minutes.
Okay, Beth, did you want to
No, I think that's fine. I mean, I think John's presentation was an excellent overview of our work, and obviously I think one of the important things here today with the panel is a lot of these issues we're working through, the collaboration that's important between my organization and Frank's organization is imperative to making this all work. And, of course, Frank stole several of my folks to make his organization more effective. So obviously you can see that collaboration goes to great depths of our organizations.
Okay, great. Okay, why don't we move right to questions then, if people have them. I have a couple from looking at the implementing arrangement, which is available on the web. If you don't have it, let me know, and I can make sure you get the link. But maybe you can tell us a little bit about some of the lists you're going to come up with, like the exclusion list. Is there anything you can add on that?
The Pentagon, I'll let you speak to the exclusion list, Beth, but the Pentagon is still, it's very close to completing the exclusion list of technology that will not be allowed to be exported underneath the treaty. It could still go to the UK and Australia underneath a license, but it will not be allowed to go underneath the treaty as an excluded item. The other primary list that we'll have to come up with fairly shortly, once the Senate provides advice and consent, is the approved community list. And I think that will be a largely state-led effort. We'll work with the UK and Australia to go over. They will put forward a series of companies and government entities that, according to the criteria laid out in the implementing arrangements, the USG will review and will make a determination if they're in the approved community or not. The other list that will be worked is going to be primarily done by DOD. AT&L will start the process there in terms of approved joint projects. There'll also be a list of approved, for lack of a better word, bilateral projects. So these are defense projects that are specific to the UK and or Australia. The UK and Australia will come forward with a series of proposals for projects they want to see in that category. DOD will take an initial scrub, come over to State Department for a foreign policy review, and then we would publish those lists probably on a website, I would imagine, so that industry is updated on a regular basis of what is and is not an approved project or who is or is not in the approved community.
In terms of the excluded technology list, my agency has, I think, served an important role of basically being a facilitator in the development of the list, because it certainly, I think, it's been characterized somewhere incorrectly as being a DITSA list, and it's not the Defense Technology Security Administration's list. We have solicited input from key stakeholders across the Department of Defense, including the military departments, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who in turn reached out to the combatant commands, and also to key agencies such as the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency and the National Security Agency. In developing the list, I just wanted to be clear that we've looked at it from the standpoint that, again, these are not technologies that won't be shared with the United Kingdom or Australia, but they are the kinds of technologies that we would tend to share on a government-to-government basis. I also think about the excluded technology list as being a living document, because I think one of the things that's important here is we are talking about a paradigm shift. And so personally, I think the list, although the list is much shorter, there's been some rumors out there about the length of the list. It's much smaller than it first started to be, because we've required everybody that has put an item on the list to justify its inclusion on the list, because I can tell you that we are also very much interested in having the treaty be used. It doesn't make any sense not to. I think it's also important to recognize that I see a relationship between the list that Frank spoke to, because obviously items that are going to go under the scope of the treaty will be able to flow fairly freely within the approved community. So obviously there are certain technologies that we do believe are appropriate on a government-to-government basis. In some cases, we'll have international treaty obligations that will require us to do that way, and we are occasionally talking about very sensitive information. I don't control all the technology release in the Department of Defense. I have other people that I need to work with, including parts of AT&L, special programs, and other things. But I think the list is, I think we've come up with a list. We have had consultation already with the Department of State on that, and we expect to give it here to the Department of State in the next day or so, and then it will soon come over and it will be shared with both the United Kingdom and Australia. Also, as I understand it, our counterparts will also, the other two countries, likely have technology that they will potentially want to exclude from the treaty, because I think another benefit of this is there is certainly work that the two countries work on, technology work, where we believe that those two countries are pursuing cutting-edge technology, and I suspect that there will be some technologies that they will want to exclude as well. But I think it's a living, breathing document, and maybe I'm in the camp who believes that once we all get accustomed to using the treaty, that I anticipate that while items might be on there in the beginning, I can imagine a conversation 6 months down the road where I call up Frank and I said, based upon what we've seen with the licenses that we are still reviewing, we believe that technology XYZ should now be able to benefit and be included in the scope of the treaty. So again, I think this will evolve over time. We're going to walk before we run, probably, at least those people of us. I'm on that side, as Arnie characterized it, who has to be. I'm the girl who can say no, but I'm also the girl who usually try to say yes and find a way ahead to say yes. So anyway, that's a little bit on the exclusions.
Great. We have one in the back.
Remy Nathan with Aerospace Industries.
Thank Remy for all his help in getting the situation here organized, along with some other people.
The situation organized.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to take credit for that.
I didn't use the word credit.
Anyway, Remy Nathan with the Aerospace Industries Association, also with the Coalition for Security and Competitiveness. Undersecretary Rood was talking a little bit about some of the structural adjustments that may be made with the commodity jurisdiction process. The coalition initially, of course, recommended certain considerations of that sort, but also talked a little bit about clarification of how the rules and regulations are interpreted and implemented across the interagency basis. Could you comment a little bit about the extent to which that may also be taken into consideration on the CJ process? And Beth, a question to you as well, somewhat related. As we're talking about these adjustments to the CJ process, could you comment to what extent, if at all, the review of the CJ process may dovetail with the current review on the technology disclosure process within DOD?
In the directive, there's a requirement, actually, that's not either state or defense, but the National Security Council will develop new guidelines on the commodity jurisdiction process. The current guidelines that we operate underneath were published in 1996, so they do need updated. So we expect the National Security Council will complete this action shortly. The parts of the directive that deal with CJs for state and defense and commerce are that a new process will be put in place, which we are developing with our interagency partners, to come to a timely decision. I think the time frame that we're envisioning is 60 days to get these decisions done so that things don't languish and industry can get a decision.
And let me just add, I think one of the things that we're going to be looking for in our improvement of the process, in addition to the possibility of timeliness, it's also very imperative that the agencies have similar information to take a look at. Running the process in the DOD, I can obviously say that, you know, we try to do the kind of analysis that we need to do to support the position that the Department of Defense wants, but it's very imperative that we share that information, because one of the things about the process that I have found that is somewhat frustrating is that we kind of have right now this escalatory process that kind of, it goes into sort of a black hole and we kind of don't know where it is, but we also sometimes aren't reviewing the same information. And while we might come to different conclusions, I think it's very important that we look at similar information and that we have the benefit of having similar information. So to the extent to which we can have predictability and transparency across the agencies in working on these decisions, I think that's very, very important. And obviously the reason we do this are to try to make it clear for exporters as to what is who really has the authority and the jurisdiction here. That's very important. Now, Remy, on your second question, I think I understood it, but if I understood it, I'm not sure I really see the linkage. So let me make sure I understood your question. You're asking whether or not this reform to the commodity jurisdiction process is going to have any implications for the review, the disclosure process we use within DOD. I see them as not being particularly related, I guess, because the what we were looking at in improving our disclosure process was in the Pentagon was making sure that we had a full appreciation that when we are working on, you know, a particular activity, you know, a foreign military sale or a cooperative project, that we understand up front all the different disclosure processes that a review has to go through. And you know, I'm a chairman of one of the processes. It's an interagency process, the National Disclosure Policy Committee, which looks at the release of classified military information to foreign governments and international organizations. And then, obviously, there are other processes, which, you know, some of these ones, we have terrible acronyms, the low-observable, counter-low-observable, XCOM, low-clo-XCOM, as those of us who call it, who are approved for the invisibility cloak device that Mr. Rood mentioned. And then we have other processes that look at the release of ComSec crypto. And so we have to make sure that we take a look at those, because what we were finding was, as we went down one of those processes, we had not laid out early and often up front all the different hurdles we needed to go through, and then we'd get close to where we wanted to, you know, move something expeditiously, and then somebody would go, whoops, we were supposed to look at this. So I see that process is not really related. I think it's going to help with working with the State Department and making sure that we are moving out much more expeditiously in providing the kind of capabilities and building partnership capacity that we want to do as part of the global war on terrorism. But and then also, to the extent to which there's export licensing supporting that, I think it'll also work with industry. This idea of sort of a technology release roadmap, we've used it very effectively with certain programs like the Joint Strike Fighter program. I'd like to see us use it with other types of programs, and so I would suggest out there to industry, I always ask you to come in and talk to my folks, because to the extent to which we have an understanding about the direction that your program's going, then we can help lay out and work with you to lay out sort of those release roadmaps and help to negotiate with through what I know can be somewhat of an opaque process. We are also, by the way, Lean Six Sigma in all those processes right now, consistent with direction from Secretary England. So that continual process improvement process with Lean Six Sigma is also being used on all those processes. My own National Disclosure Policy Committee process has already gone through the Lean Six Sigma exercise, and we have found a tremendous number of opportunities for improvement, even within a process that I will say is a pretty good process. But again, I don't see the, I don't, maybe I'm missing something, but I don't see the specific relationship to the CJ process that perhaps you saw. So,
but there is another aspect of the presidential directive that will impact what we do on commodity jurisdictions. The current process is a paper process by which there's a CJ issue emerges. The State Department makes a determination. We get a piece of paper from somewhere in the Commerce Department. It comes to somewhere in the State Department. DOD then provides a piece of paper. It's an arcane system. So the interagency dispute mechanism that's envisioned will certainly take this challenge on. So you'll have a group of people that will meet on a regular basis, Beth, myself, and Matt Borman at Commerce, and sit down with the three of us in a room, not over the phone, being distracted by 10,000 other things, and say, okay, where are we going to come out on this CJ process today? So it will help, I think.
Okay, we have two up in the front here. I think Terry was first there.
Terry Murphy with MK Technology and also CSIS. Just a follow-up on what you just said, Frank. When I think the Undersecretary said there would be two permanent members of the committee. One would be State and one would be Defense, and Commerce would be brought in as needed, and so would DHS. You're now indicating that Matt Borman would be there, I heard, sort of on a regular basis. And I wonder if you could just explore the parameters of those two statements, his and yours.
Undersecretary Rood's statement was correct. The presidential direction says specifically the committee is comprised of the State Department and the Defense Department. On matters involving commodity jurisdiction, the Commerce Department will always be invited. There could be an instance where State and DOD don't agree on a license or an arms sale of some sort. In those meetings, the Commerce Department would not have a seat because they don't have a role in deciding what arms sales DOD and State decide we want to authorize for export. Now, in the instances where you're talking about a commodity jurisdiction or an enforcement matter that DHS has an equity in, then DHS would be invited along with Commerce, but State and DOD would always be there. We'd also invite the intel community as needed, and other agencies as appropriate, but it's the Secretary of State's authority, with DOD as the only permanent member, to invite folks as their equities are going to be addressed. But yes, okay. Undersecretary Rood was absolutely correct.
Gibson LaBeouf with Raytheon. Thanks very much for sitting up here and taking these questions from us. Going back to the treaties and the disclosure boards that, Beth, that you addressed, the LOCLO, your board, the NDP, do you, in today's process, when industry goes in for a license, a lot of our difficulty lies in that those licenses need to be reviewed most of the time by the LOCLO board or by your board or by some of the military boards to determine whether that technology is going to be transferred or not. Do you envision with the treaties that technology will be defined such that these boards will be excluded from having to play a role and that technology will be exchanged back and forth in that manner? I'm not trying to get to your exclusionary list, but I'm just I'm really trying to get a feel for whether at the end of the day we are still going to have to do the processing through the boards. And if we do, could you then address perhaps if there's a timetable for when these Lean Six Sigma projects will complete and improve the process on those boards? Thank you.
I would just make one opening point, then Beth can address this one. Underneath the treaty, if an item is not excluded, so there's a range of technology that can go out for export underneath the treaty, there's no contact with the U.S. government. So the LOCLO committee would not have a opportunity to look at the transaction. The LOCLO will have played its part in determining what items are excluded from the treaty. So, anyways.
Yeah, and just to add on to that, I mean, again, the scope of the treaty, we're going to try to, you got to look at it this in a comprehensive way. I mean, everybody's focusing on, you know, that's where I hate to be the steward of Article 3.2 of the treaty. The thing about it is the Defense Department cares about Article 3.1, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, and Delta, okay, the treaty. We care about the fact that, we're trying to facilitate combined military operations, cooperative projects, projects of Her Majesty's government, and projects of the United States government. So we want to use the treaty. So, again, Frank says, is if it meets the thresholds for being included in the scope of the treaty, then we will basically forego all of these review processes. Now, back to what I said about the exempted technologies, which is, Gibb, why I said you want to know what the exempted list says. Needless to say, some of the most sensitive technologies, the Department of Defense is going to say, we probably have the opportunity to look at that for the first time. And you also need to listen very closely to what I said, which is 6 months down the road, I anticipate turning to Frank and say, you know what, that invisible cloaking device, which, by the way, was on the exempted technologies list to start with, I no longer have to see the invisibility cloaking device because I'm very comfortable with the fact that that invisible cloaking device can go anywhere within in the community because I have no concern about it. It can go within the community anywhere. In fact, we should all benefit from the invisible cloaking device. So, again, did the LOCLO participate in the development of the exclusion list? Yes. Did other stakeholders in the Department of Defense participate in the development of the list? Yes. And again, I think it's a work in progress. It is not etched in stone. It did not come down from the mountain, and it will change. So, you know, but again, we're going to try to maximize things being in Article 3.1, Alpha, Bravo, and Charlie, and try to have what is in Article 3.2 be as minimal as necessary.
Maybe I could ask a kind of a follow-up, which is, can you talk a little bit about how the treaty arrangements will handle retransfers and re-exports? I mean, there's some exceptions, there's some changes, and there's some things that continue. So,
for an item that's in the United Kingdom underneath the treaty. So it's qualified for export from the United States underneath the treaty. It can go to any member of the approved community without any reauthorization from the U.S. government or the U.K. government. If a company that's in the approved community decides it wants to send that item to either a company in the U.K. outside the approved community or to a re-export outside of the United Kingdom, period, to France or to Germany, at that point, you have to get the authorization of the United Kingdom government. And our agreement with the U.K. is that the U.S. would have an opportunity to say yes or no to that transaction.
Okay. Other questions?
Can I also just come back? I gave Gibbs such a long-winded answer to his question that I actually didn't address one part of his question. In terms of the Lean Six Sigma processes, we're proceeding apace with all of the different processes going through that. And I'm very much interested, and I know General Schaefer is committed to having his process, which by the basic nature of the technology that the low observable process handles, it's not necessarily the most transparent of processes, and it's understandable. But Paul is committed to looking at that and having people who have to, not only those that are involved in the community participating, but those who have to, people that have to interface with the process. And the other thing that I think I will just say about all these processes is that a day does not go by that I don't speak to Paul Schaefer. He and I have a very hand-in-glove relationship. I sit on the XCOM. We have a lot more overlap and understanding, and the relationship between the committees, we've made it much more effective on a daily basis. May not always be that open to you and industry to see that, but I can tell you that the interaction between that community and my inclusion in that community is significantly improved. And, I mean, I've talked to Paul already twice today, and the day's not done. So.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
Quick follow-up to Frank's question with regard to the treaty retransfer. So under that scenario, the U.S. side would not have to apply for a license, would just rely on the U.K. side to apply for or provide the notification back to the states for approval.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay. We have one in the back, and we're getting close to the entry. We got one there and one there, so.
Beth Mersch, north of Grumman. Given that this is an election year, and I saw in the press yesterday that the Senate had not yet scheduled the hearings, I wondered if you had some thoughts on the scheduling of hearings and a potential ratification in the Senate on the treaties.
I told Frank that if he got a really tough question, he could say, that's a great question, and I want to take it back and...
Oh, I didn't know. You didn't tell me that was the rule. I'm sorry.
I think just at least from my discussions with the staff that's tracking the treaty on the Hill, I think there's an interest to get to approach and provide, consider advice and consent earlier than later.
Oh, okay.
That's why he was smiling when he was listening to the question. He had that ready.
All right. We had one over here, didn't we? I think, yeah. He's learned his lessons well at State.
I wanted to actually take a look back to the funding levels again and the staffing levels at DDTC that were remarked upon earlier. Given the increase in licenses and the fact that the budget request is flat in terms of funding and staffing, how much money are we talking about in terms of the self-financing mechanism, and how many FTEs might that provide for license processing?
Well, Let me first lay out the problem a little bit. Like as Undersecretary Root said, you have the Department of State approaching around 80,000 licenses for defense trade, valued at about $1 billion in authorized trade. We have approximately around 40 licensing officers that currently handle that volume. So if you consider that we've driven down the number of pending licenses by 50%, while at the same time still facing an increase in the licenses we're receiving, is quite an accomplishment. But there's only so much efficiency you can get out of the system. So at some point you have to hire more people. So the process that we're considering underneath the presidential directives will certainly require additional hiring at the Department of State. But we're, as Undersecretary Root said, we're still considering the mechanism and the plan by which we would do that in terms of self-financing and other avenues of revenue. And I would also just try to amplify something a little bit that the Undersecretary said. We currently have a fee structure where we require industry to register and pay a certain fee every 2 years. So this I think this kind of gets to the question of, would we be beholden to industry to make a decision? We're already in the position where industry pays for the service. You have to register with the Defense Trade Control Bureau to conduct defense trade.
Okay. Let me try one. If you can dodge this one, if you don't like it, then I have an easy one. The we have this community of companies within the UK that are approved. What do you do to make sure their employees within the company are approved? I mean, what are the processes? That's something presumably the UK does, but...
In the implementing arrangements, we have gone into the issue of dual nationals, third country nationals. So we have paid a lot of attention to that and how we'll get to the approved community.
Okay. They have different requirements. So here's the easy question. I'm going to ask this one as the last question, unless anybody has any burning. Okay. The easy question is, what would you say to people who say that the directives are inconsequential or that the administration would not follow through? I know your initial remark, of course, is pshaw. But,
that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah. And I do think, to expand on a little bit, when I started out and said that you didn't have to track this for a long time because the rate of change was so slow, that is not true anymore. So that's consequential right in and of itself. But maybe you want to expand on that a little bit.
When I got to the Director of Defense Trade Control in May of 2007, we decided to implement a review mechanism by which the Deputy Assistant Secretary would review any license over a certain number of days. And I went over to DOD, and I was briefed how DOD reviews licenses, and I asked folks where at DDTC how they do licenses. So we decided to implement a system whereas any license over a certain number of days would have to come to the DAS for a decision. And we tried to draw the line, should it be 45 days, should it be 60 days? So our initial objective, I think, in early July was it'll be 60 days. Well, we couldn't do 60 days because there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of licenses that were over 60 days. So I would have spent my entire week reviewing licenses. So we originally set it at 90 days. And even there, it was at 100 in some cases over 90 days. So over the course of the summer and the fall, we drove those numbers down just to share accountability to a 60-day review, which I no longer do, but Bob does. And we literally, at least for the hardware licenses, we are only maybe a handful of cases get over the 60-day mark. So I would just consider that in the context of when we talked about in the presidential directives putting forward a fixed time frame. Again, one of the first things I noticed when I got to DDTC was, where's the executive order that lays out how we do licenses? And there wasn't one. So the presidential directive tells us to do that. It instructs the PM Bureau that it has to complete a license in 60 days. That has never been even contemplated in this area in the past. So I think it's a significant change, and it really gets at what at least the coalition was trying to get at, which was predictable, reliable, transparent decisions that you can make business decisions and rely upon. So that I think, is the significance of certainly the 60-day licensing time frame.
Beth, did you
Yeah, I guess I just want to add that you've heard several words today, and I think those words are very important. I mean, the idea that people like Frank and myself are committed to having this process be more timely and predictable and more transparent in decision-making. Personally, I feel with some of the tough decisions I've made, I'd rather make them quickly. I mean, because you all out here, for you, time is money. So if the answer is going to be no, why don't I tell you the no sooner rather than drag it out for 60 or 90 days and then say no? So again, and that transparency works both directions, which is, again, I think it's very helpful for you all in industry to have these kinds of forums where we can work together because, again, we've got to work not only across agencies but also with industry, and to the extent to which I think there perhaps you can look at the directives and you might say, well, that's not very revolutionary. I think those of us who are involved in it, we're going to put in place the kinds of processes and the mechanisms between the agencies that will go on after Frank and I no longer do this, because we can't put in place a system that is personality dependent. It's got to be able to survive and be something that actually works and goes on. And personally, I think these are excellent steps, and I'm just pleased to see, and I want to share, again, I think we've got some good practices, in fact, some best practices in the DOD, and to the extent to which we can share those with our colleagues in the Department of State, I'm pleased to do so.
Let me start by thanking a few people. We had a lot of help in setting this up from NAM, the Chamber of Commerce, from AIA, and from other coalition members. And without them, this wouldn't have been able to work. And I think we'll be doing some things with them in the future that we'll let you know about. Second, I hope you can join me in thanking our two speakers here.